I'm Liz Carr, and in this two-part BBC World Service documentary, I'm going to visit each of the five countries where it's legal, under certain circumstances, to ask someone to kill you. It's complicated. In some places, you can ask a doctor to give you a lethal injection in an act called euthanasia. In others, it's assisted suicide, where someone else, usually a doctor, helps you end your life yourself. And there's lots of other terms, such as aid in dying or death with dignity. Now, I'm against legalising assisted death in any form. I'm not religious, against suicide, nor anti-choice. But I do worry that once we allow state-sanctioned killing, there's no going back. And as a disabled person who's had more than their fair share of involvement with the medical profession, I fear giving medics even more power over our lives. So I want to learn how these laws work in practice, and I want to see if I really am justified in fearing such a law coming into force in my own country. First up, Switzerland, synonymous worldwide with assisted suicide, thanks to the fact that it's the only country where people from anywhere in the world, if they meet the criteria, can be helped to die.
Oh, it's chilly in here, isn't it?
Yes. So you see, this is now not in a good order, but this is the bed where normally people would lie. Some people prefer to die on a chair, so this is their decision. It's nothing special.
It's just a very plain.
Very plain.
Quite small. I thought it would be bigger. I don't know why, but I did think it would be bigger.
Yeah, sure. It is really very small.
This is Giancarlo Zucco from the Swiss Right to Die organisation EXIT. EXIT help people through the assisted suicide process, and Giancarlo is one of their volunteers. He's showing me the room at their offices where people can come if they have nowhere else to die. It's a cold room next to the kitchen, and someone had died there the previous night. There was still an empty coffee cup on the bedside table and the dirty laundry on a chair.
Well, first of all, I have a feeling of solidarity for people who suffer, and also for animals. I am convinced that every one of us has the right to decide about his life and about his death, how and when he wants or she wants to die.
So over the years, how many people have you assisted to die, do you think?
The exact figures, I don't know, because I never counted it, but out of a feeling, I can say over 200, something like that. Only about one third of the people who apply finally die with EXIT. We always say that being a member of EXIT gives you a sort of a death insurance, because some people who are not really suffering terribly, when they know that they have this EXIT opportunity, they decide that they want to live longer.
If you want assisted suicide in Switzerland, it's most likely a volunteer like Giancarlo rather than a doctor who'll help you with the process. Georg Bossard is a Swiss medical ethicist. He told me how it works.
There is the article 115 in our penal code. It's actually a pretty old article, so it's not an article designed to legislate on assisted suicide. But what the article says basically is that suicide is not a crime and assisted suicide is not a crime either, as long as there are no selfish motives of the individual carrying out the assistance. It was not at all linked to the medical profession or not at all linked to terminally ill people. I think it was rather linked to questions like honour and things like that.
So in Switzerland, anyone can assist a suicide, so long as they don't personally benefit from it. But whilst the law establishing this dates back to 1873, it wasn't until the 1970s that the organisation EXIT campaigned to extend its use to those who were ill and dying by decriminalising medically assisted suicide. Now, about 500 Swiss people use this law every year, less than 1% of all deaths in Switzerland.
Does the law of assisted suicide, or the way it's practised, does it work?
I would say this basically is an issue that can't be sufficiently regulated. But among all these bad systems, I would say our system is not the worst. There is something we call it a harm-reducing approach. You know, if you have things like prostitution or illegal drugs or assisted suicide, it's something that probably you were happy not to have it within a society, but in some context you can't avoid it. And I think then it's better to have it open on the plate than below the table. But still the cases are very, very rare. To a certain degree it's a hype in the media.
The hype Georg is talking about is mainly centred on Dignitas, the controversial right to die organisation in Zurich. They regularly hit the headlines because they're prepared to assist people from abroad to end their own lives. In the past 10 years, they've helped more than 1,000 suicide tourists from all over the world. But most people who use the law are Swiss, and in most cases, the drug is prescribed at their request and by their own doctor. I spoke to Denise, whose husband René died at a new Right to Die organisation called Life Circle.
Hatte Bauchspeicheldrüsenkrebs.
He had terminal pancreatic cancer, and the doctors gave him 5 months to live, but he managed to hold on for nearly 2 years. At the beginning, he was afraid of death. He clung to life. But in the end, he was so ill that he really longed for death. And once we had a date set, it was as if he'd been released.
What was it like to be present at the end?
The last two nights that we had together before the appointment, we almost forgot he was ill. We were together the whole time. It was really wonderful. But then on Thursday morning, it was as if time started passing more quickly. The assistant arrived, and at first he tried to take it as an injection, but we couldn't find a vein because he was so thin. So then he took it as a liquid. And then it was very emotional. But it was what he really wanted, right to the end. He didn't want to live like that anymore.
After he took the lethal medication, Denise's husband went into a coma. But it wasn't a quick death. It took nearly 21 hours for him to die.
He just kept sleeping. It was as if he was catching up on the sleep he'd missed when he was ill. He wanted to die in the caravan. So we spent the whole night there together, with the assistant. And the next morning, it started to rain. He'd always loved the rain on the roof of the caravan. And at that moment, it was over. Then the police came, and the coroner, and the forensic team. And they were all very nice. But actually, I feel worse now, because I miss him. But it's still so good to know that it was just what René wanted.
Talking to Denise was very emotional. It was an uncomfortable conversation and one I wasn't sure I wanted to have. Not because my heart doesn't go out to them, but because this is the kind of story we're used to hearing. When the media usually covers the topic of assisted suicide, it does so by following the stories of people who want to die. Tragic stories that leave most of us thinking, if that was me, I'd want to die. But we're rarely told the other stories. The stories of all those who die a peaceful and natural death at home. Or the fact that most people who are ill, old or disabled, maybe unable to speak, move or breathe unaided, don't inevitably want an assisted death. And many people who use the Swiss assisted suicide laws aren't terminally ill like Denise's husband. Instead, they're suffering from ongoing conditions which won't kill them, but which they consider make their lives intolerable. Peter Verley is a disability activist who's opposed to assisted suicide. He's from the Centre for Independent Living in Zurich.
I can understand an individual who suffers from pain every day that he will want to die. I can understand that, and I do not, on the individual level, judge this person. But as a policy, to favour killing these people when they are in despair and in great pain, instead of doing everything we can in order to help them, and there is a lot lacking.
Peter thinks, and this is a view I share, that the right to assisted suicide is not the most important question here.
Our policy is that we will not discuss rights of assisted suicide or any laws about assisted suicide as long as independent living is not a natural possibility for people with disabilities. As long as people with a disability are forced to live in institutions and are not allowed to be part of society, you cannot speak about self-determined death, because then death will always be a result of not being allowed to live.
I've had an interesting time here in Switzerland. It's somewhere where assisted suicide has been part of the culture for so long that people just think it's the natural, dignified thing to do. But to me, as someone opposed to assisted suicide and as a disabled person, it was weird being somewhere where it's so normalised. And I'm not in a hurry to visit any more death clinics. But for now, we travel from the oldest to the newest assisted suicide law as we head to Luxembourg. I'm in a cab in Luxembourg City. When you think of Luxembourg, you think of quaint little chocolate box buildings. Luxembourg is the most recent country to pass a law allowing euthanasia and assisted suicide that's been enacted since 2009. So how did that happen? Because it's a very, very Catholic country. And when it passed, apparently it caused a constitutional crisis. So I've come to find out more. Jean Hus from the Luxembourg Green Party and Lydie Ayer of the Socialist Party were the two leading MPs responsible for pushing the law through Parliament. Clearly, it's an incredibly controversial issue, this. But in Luxembourg, it did lead to a constitutional crisis. Well, that's what it is in the headlines.
That was not our intention. It was not under intention.
Are you sure?
No. We wanted...
Nobody could imagine this. But this is a very, from an institutional point of view, this is a very important incident. It's going to be a very high price to be paid by the monarchy to have done this opposition.
When the final bill went to the Grand Duke Henri to sign, he refused on the grounds of his Catholic faith. In response, the Luxembourg Parliament actually changed their constitution, so he no longer has any role in enacting laws. Martine Mergen from the Christian Socialist Party opposed the law.
I think it was a very political discussion in Luxembourg. What was most difficult was after the first vote, where we saw we lost, people don't want politicians or churches to tell them what they have to do in their private life. And we said, okay, they are right. We should try to have a civilized law to respect the will of the majority of the politicians, but also of a big part of our population, to have this liberty to choose for themselves.
But as a doctor, Martine Mergen's concerned about the law.
For me, it was very, very difficult to put doctors outside of general penal laws. That's a problem. I think the law gave us a power that we never had before.
Do you think that when there is a law, that it puts a pressure, any pressure, on a person? Because it's there. You could have euthanasia if you wanted it.
This question of pressure was one of my main points in my intervention in the Chamber of Deputies. There could be a pressure on persons, even if it did not express wish to euthanasia before, that being a burden to the persons who take care of them. And it's very difficult. You can be a good professional in health care and palliative care, but with your body language, or you can sometimes you're just overworked and fed up, and you might have just a movement or a face pull that makes the person think I'm a burden to them.
Only five people have used the Luxembourg law so far, and even opponents of the law admit there's not yet been evidence of any problems. I asked Hus and Ayer, the law's sponsors, if they were happy with what they'd achieved.
Oh, I know we talked about, you know, that you get this bill through and you must be proud of that achievement. Is it the bill you wanted to get through?
No, not really, because I have taken off different pieces, for example, the minors. It's not the best law, but it is the best possible law under these circumstances.
And even though in the first year only five people used the law, you still think it was worth fighting for if only a small group of people are going to use it?
It's about liberty, it's not about figures. Liberty of choice.
It's not a championship for having more euthanasia than other countries. No, it's in the sense to help people to find the end in their way. There is a song of a very well-known American singer.
You're not going
singer.
To sing now.
No, I will not sing, but
he's
singing My Way.
Yes.
My Way. Hmm? Mm. And I think It's the last freedom you may have. I cannot impose to another how he has to go.
To me, this is what's alarming about assisted death legislation, how easily a law can be changed once it's been introduced. The Luxembourg campaign has pushed for a law with strict limits and safeguards, which seems reasonable to most. But then the next step is to extend it to less straightforward groups like under-18s or people with dementia. Campaigners against assisted suicide, like me, often talk about the slippery slope, and I think this is what it means. Once a law's in, it's unlikely ever to go away. And when it gets extended, it's without all the debate and discussion that you have when it first goes through. It hasn't happened in Luxembourg yet. They've only had 5 cases so far. But the way the people who pushed it through talk about the law makes me worried for the future. Next up, Belgium, which since 2002 is the only place where euthanasia is legal, but assisted suicide isn't. That means that in Belgium, your doctor administers the life-ending medication.
The way the medication is given is not important, really. It's important to give it very quietly, without pain, but the patient may drink or be injected. If the doctor is there, there is no difference.
Dominique Lossignol is a doctor and vice president of the Belgian Right to Die organisation, ADMD. He says the passing of the law just legalised what people were doing anyway.
We knew it was a reality. It was hidden, of course. It was a clandestine activity. Once you talk about a problem, you avoid clandestinity. I did practice euthanasia before the law. I don't do that more now.
According to government figures, euthanasia cases represented about 1% of all deaths in Belgium last year. And numbers have gone up every year since the legislation.
The other side of the coin is what to do without law with this type of situation. Because we have a law, we take a lot of precautions. We are aware about what we have to do, what not to do, to be sure that there is no mistake. If there is no law, you know, it's everybody do what he wants.
When the Belgian law says euthanasia, it means voluntary euthanasia, requested by the patient. It's not up to the doctor to decide. But Corinne Brochier of the European Institute for Bioethics says this isn't always the case.
Euthanasia in Belgium is not always asked by the person who is dying. Sometimes, well, the family is suffering. Is suffering seeing the person also suffering. And they go and talk to the doctor and say, okay, can you do something to help that person? And when they say help to go quicker, everybody understand that, okay, what's the point? If you give a little bit more of this product, it's easier for her, for that person. So the pressure comes from the family sometimes. The pressure comes also from the staff, medical staff.
And the other issue is that the only way euthanasia cases in Belgium get documented is in reports by the same doctor who carried it out. The British Medical Journal estimated in 2010 that only around half of all euthanasia cases in Belgium get properly reported.
If they are a little bit outside the framework of the law, they don't want to fill in the form. They don't want to put themselves in jail. And another point is that in 10 years of euthanasia in Belgium, there has not been even one doctor who has been condemned. I don't believe that we Belgians are so good in respecting the law. No, it is that there is no political will to control the doctors and to control euthanasia practice in Belgium.
One of the main opposition groups to euthanasia in Belgium is the Catholic Church. Bert van der Hagens is a Catholic chaplain who lives and works in a hospital that carries out euthanasia.
If you look at the debates today, we are changing paradigms. We come from a paradigm from almost 2,500 years. Because of the Christian influence and the mixture with Hippocratic ethics, you had this sanctity of life doctrine, which stated that doctors should do anything to make sure that life was preserved. Then in the 60s, 70s, you got this quality of life doctrine coming up, because medicine could do a lot of things At a certain point, people started to talk about, yeah, but what they do, is this a good thing? And quality of life is very subjective. Who can decide what the quality of life is? That's the, only the person can do that.
The most recent example of this in Belgium was the double euthanasia of a pair of deaf twins who decided they wanted euthanasia after losing their sight. But Bert says that in his experience, these decisions are never black and white. And he worries that a situation might develop where people's economic worth could be a factor in their death.
What will happen if the economy is not reviving? If care is taking up too much money of the gross national product and they have to cut? Will the state, without saying it, perhaps there's some, yeah, the idea is put into our brains, once you are useless, you're not economically fit to provide anything to the economy. I'm of no use, I'm a burden, I'm socially isolated, why should I live? This is really the survival of the fittest. If you don't belong to the fittest, you have the moral duty to make sure that you vanish yourself. But can this really be an autonomous choice?
To me, that's the biggest problem with a law on assisted suicide. At a time when we're experiencing cuts in health and social care, how can we be sure that assisted suicide doesn't become the easy option? I've come to the end of the first half of my trip and I'm exhausted. I've spoken to people from all sides of the argument, and I'm still not sure. Am I right to fear the legalisation of assisted suicide or euthanasia? Most of the people I've spoken to seem to have been working in good faith, whichever side they're on. But for me, the question is still, can you balance the right of the individual who wants to die with the responsibility of society to protect people who don't? And it's hard to be sure we're really hearing what people want, and not what we think they want. During this part of the trip, I had to return to the UK to visit my uncle, who was dying of lung cancer. When the palliative consultant approached him in his last hours, she heard him say, "I want to go." She made him repeat it, "I want to go." After three times, she realised he was actually saying, "I want to know." He didn't want to die. He wanted to know what was going to happen to him next. Even with my beliefs, I also thought he'd said, "I want to go." A few hours later, he died peacefully and naturally and with his family around him. In the next programme, I visit the Netherlands and the USA to learn about how they tackle the issue of assisted suicide and euthanasia. So join me then.